You know, every major decision you make, buying a house, investing in a stock, drafting a climate policy, or even just choosing a college major, it all relies entirely on something that, well, something that doesn't actually exist.
Right, because it hasn't happened yet.
Exactly. You are making these massive, life-altering bets on a ghost. Because the future hasn't happened yet, there are literally no facts about it. So, I mean, how do we study it? How do we even prepare for it?
Well, that realization that there are no quote-unquote future facts, it completely upends how we normally think about gathering knowledge.
Yeah.
When you study history, you know, you're digging through archives for material realities, letters, treaties, carbon-dated fossils. You construct a narrative based on what is already physically there.
Stuff you can touch.
Exactly. But the future only exists right now as an idea.
Right, right. Welcome to Futures Research Unpacked. Today's deep dive is anchored by an intensely thought-provoking 2021 conceptual paper by Magnus and colleagues, and it's titled Futures Literacy and the Diversity of the Future.
It's a fascinating piece of theoretical work.
It really is. And our mission today, for you, the listener, is to unpack what it actually means to be futures literate.
Yeah.
Because if there are no facts to uncover, then, well, okay, let's unpack this. Thinking about the future isn't like predicting the weather with a supercomputer. It's more like writing a movie script together without realizing what genre we're in.
That framing gets right to the core of the debate this paper enters.
Mm-hmm.
The authors argue that our traditional ways of predicting the future are fundamentally flawed because they lacked something called reflexivity.
Reflexivity. Okay.
Yeah, they treat the tools we use to imagine the future, like telescopes, you know, we're just passively observing a reality that is approaching us. But those tools aren't telescopes.
They're what then?
They're paintbrushes. Mm-hmm. They are actively shaping what the future becomes. The paper suggests they are tools of creation disguised as tools of prediction.
Oh, wow. So the act of predicting the future actually shapes the future. That's wild. So to understand why we need to change our approach, let's look at what we're currently doing. The paper introduces this concept of futures literacy, which was pioneered by Real Miller.
Right. Miller's work is foundational here.
Yeah. And he defines it as the ability to understand our inherent future-oriented behavior and act upon the later than now.
And this taps into what anthropologist Arjun Appadurai studied. He looked at this underlying instinct and called it the capacity to aspire.
The capacity to aspire.
Yeah. And he observed this even in the world's poorest populations, noting how people constantly orient themselves toward imagined better realities. It is a universal human trait. We all strive toward realities that are different from our present.
Right. Everyone has goals.
Exactly. But for the vast majority of us, this is just an implicit background process. We go about our daily lives saving money, planning vacations, without actively analyzing the futures we're actually designing.
Well, on a personal level, I mean, that makes total sense. We're just living our lives. But on a macro level, institutions are trying to be very analytical about this, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Like, over the past few decades, specific forward-looking practices, scenario development, simulation modeling, massive spreadsheet projections, these have become the absolute staples of global governance. You walk into any corporate boardroom or UN summit, and they are armed with these predictive models stretching out to 2050.
And they rely incredibly heavily on quantitative data. The overarching belief in those rooms is that if we can just gather enough variables, process enough data, apply enough expert knowledge, we can essentially eliminate the uncertainty of tomorrow.
But, and this is where I start to question things, looking at the complex overlapping crises we face today, like climate change, global pandemics, artificial intelligence, are we just using 20th century tools for 21st century problems?
The paper would definitely argue yes.
Because relying purely on predictive math for modern crises, it feels dangerous. It's like trying to use a printed map for a road trip where the roads keep physically shifting underneath your tires.
That is a perfect way to put it, and the paper makes exactly this distinction. Traditional predictive models work beautifully for complicated problems, but they struggle immensely with what they call wicked problems.
Wicked problems, right?
Yeah. A wicked problem is a complex, undefined social or environmental issue with no single clear solution. A linear extrapolation on a spreadsheet works great right up until a radical rupture occurs.
Like a pandemic.
Like a pandemic, or a sudden technological leap, or a global supply chain collapse. The traditional models completely fail to capture paradigm shifts.
Which explains the massive disconnect we see in policy today. The paper points to this, calling it the knowledge action gap, and also the value action gap.
Right. It's that divide between what we know and what we do.
Yeah, because we have mountains of data on climate change, for example. We know the projected sea level rise down to the millimeter, but that knowledge just isn't translating into the necessary transformative action. Knowing the future and actually processing and acting on the future, they're two very different things.
Exactly. The 20th century methods of prediction just don't hold up when you are searching for fundamental systems change.
Right.
We gather all this data, but we find ourselves paralyzed because the models don't tell us how to change the underlying system. They just tell us what happens if we don't.
So if the rigid models alone aren't enough, we clearly have to try something else to grasp what's going on. And this is where the paper categorizes the different ways humanity actually engages with the future to show us what is missing.
Yes. The authors adapt a framework by Muderman and colleagues. It outlines four distinct epistemological approaches, four lenses through which humanity tries to grasp the future.
And seeing these four approaches laid out side by side, it really reveals the blind spots in how we operate.
It really does. So the first approach is the most familiar. It's the predictive lens. This assumes the future is at least partly knowable if we just have the right data. It focuses heavily on probabilities, risk mitigation, that sort of thing.
This is the realm of the actuary, right? Or the insurance adjuster. You look at 50 years of flood data to decide exactly how high to build a seawall. You look at historical stock market returns to plan your retirement portfolio. The mechanics are simple. You take the past and you draw a straight line forward.
Exactly. And the social function of this approach is to inspire confidence. It allows a government or a corporation to stand in front of the public and say, we have identified the risks, we've quantified them, and we have a plan. It gives a sense of grip.
But since predicting exact probabilities usually fails when a wicked problem hits, planners have to pivot. They have to stop asking what will happen and start asking what could happen. Which leads us into the second lens.
The plausible approach. This approach embraces deep uncertainty. Instead of trying to predict one single highly probable future, you build multiple diverging future pathways. The goal is to test our adaptive capacity.
So it's like asking, if a global pandemic shuts down shipping lanes, are we ready? If a new technology renders our core product obsolete overnight, are we ready?
Yes, the focus here isn't about perfectly predicting the exact future. It's about stress testing your organization against a variety of futures. It's heavily focused on systems thinking and resilience. You practice with different scenarios so you aren't caught off guard.
Okay, so those first two lenses, predictive and plausible, they definitely dominate the corporate and policy worlds today. They're comfortable because they still rely on analyzing existing trends.
They're very safe.
But here's where it gets really interesting, because I'll be honest, when I was reading through this framework, I found myself kind of pushing back on the need for anything else. Like, wait, aren't predictive models inherently better because they rely on hard data and math? If we're trying to make serious global policy about infrastructure or the economy, why do we need the next two approaches? The experimental or critical approaches. They sound a bit like academic art projects.
You'd think the math is safer. But what's fascinating here is that relying purely on the math can actually close down our range of options.
Close them down? How?
Because if your spreadsheet is only built on current trends, it is literally blind to transformative change. The paper argues that our cultural obsession with quantitative data, what we consider valuable knowledge, inadvertently traps us. You end up just projecting the present onto the future, carrying all of today's flaws and limitations with you.
Oh, I see. So you trap yourself in the status quo because your math is only based on the status quo.
Precisely. If you only look at historical data on fossil fuel consumption, your models will never show you a world powered entirely by decentralized renewable energy. They will just show you slightly more efficient fossil fuel consumption. That is why the third lens, the experimental approach, is so vital.
Right. Because it's deeply constructivist.
Yes. It is about the collective co-creation and imagination of radical new futures. You're building the future from scratch rather than just reacting to it.
But how do you actually do an experimental approach in practice? Like, what does that look like?
Well, you don't look at past data. You bring together a diverse group of people, artists, citizens, scientists, marginalized voices, who are usually completely left out of policy planning.
Okay.
You give them a blank slate and say, design a city that produces absolutely zero waste, or design an economic system not based on infinite growth. You work backward from a radical imagination rather than forward from current trends.
Right.
The paper calls this building world-making capacity.
World-making capacity. I love that phrase. It shifts the entire paradigm. The future isn't a destination we are traveling toward. It's a place we are actively constructing.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, if we have the capacity to build futures, we also have to look very closely at the futures that have already been built for us, right?
Exactly. Which brings us to the fourth lens, the critical approach.
The analytical one.
Yes, but not in a mathematical sense. It's more like reverse engineering a magic trick. It doesn't necessarily create new futures itself. Instead, it focuses on interrogating how dominant visions of the future take hold in society and assessing their political implications.
It deconstructs the narratives we've been handed.
Exactly. It asks who benefits from this specific vision of tomorrow.
So recognizing these four distinct approaches, predictive, plausible, experimental, and critical, this leads directly to the paper's ultimate thesis, because true futures literacy requires something beyond just using these tools, right? It requires reflexivity.
Reflexivity is the absolute linchpin of this entire framework. It means having the conscious awareness of which approach you are using, why you chose it over the others, and what power it exerts. It's about understanding the tools you're holding.
And the paper introduces this brilliant phrase to describe how this power operates in the real world: techniques of futuring.
Yes.
These are practices that bring actors together around an imagined future to orient their actions in the present. Because, again, the future doesn't exist yet, but the image of the future makes people spend money and pass laws right now.
The social function of an imagined future is its capacity to inform meaning and stimulate action today. To illustrate how incredibly powerful this is, the authors detail a real-world intervention from the Netherlands. It was called 2050, an energetic odyssey.
Yeah, this wasn't a dry UN white paper. It was a massive curated audiovisual installation. They took a hand-picked audience, high-level business leaders, politicians, investors, put them in this immersive environment, and showed them a deeply detailed depiction of the Netherlands powered entirely by North Sea wind turbines.
And it was designed to create what the authors call a reality effect.
A reality effect.
Yeah, by carefully staging this future with immersive visuals and sound, they suspended the audience's disbelief. It wasn't about convincing them with a spreadsheet. It was about fostering a collective belief in a specific imagined future.
Wow.
It brought these powerful people together and aligned their orientations so they would leave that room and literally start funding and building that exact vision.
They literally programmed a new future into the minds of the people who had the capital to build it. That's an incredible example of the experimental approach in action. But it also exposes a massive vulnerability, doesn't it?
It really does.
Because they programmed a green, renewable future in that specific instance. But what if the people doing the programming have ulterior motives? The paper doesn't shy away from this dark side. The danger lies in what sociologist Stephen Lukes calls ideological power.
Yes, ideological power. It is the ability to shape people's wishes and desires without them even realizing it. The paper argues that the power to determine what a population thinks is conceivable is the highest form of power.
This is where the paper completely blew my mind, specifically with their example of self-driving cars.
Oh, that's a great example.
Think about it. Every commercial, every tech keynote, every sci-fi movie from the last decade, they present autonomous self-driving cars as an absolute inevitable fact of the year 2040. We don't even question it anymore. We just assume our current cars will eventually drive themselves.
But the paper points out that this widespread assumption reveals way more about corporate power shaping our imaginations than it does about what is actually a plausible or even desirable future.
Right.
By accepting the self-driving car as destiny, we completely stop imagining alternatives.
Like, what about robust high-speed public transit? What about walkable 15-minute cities where you don't even need a car? The assumption of the self-driving car is just corporate power shaping our imagination to sell a future product, but it's disguised as a natural trajectory of human progress. We've been sold a marketing campaign so effectively that we think it's a law of physics.
It is a profound realization. When we lack reflexivity, when we don't apply that critical lens, we implicitly accept futures designed by others. And those, quote unquote, others, usually have a vested financial or political interest in that specific future taking shape. We mistake their profit model for our destiny.
It's like corporate power is programming the destination into our collective GPS. We're just sitting in the passenger seat arguing over the route.
That's exactly it.
So what does this all mean? How do we take the steering wheel back?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, reflexivity is the antidote to this blind acceptance. By understanding the prior commitments framing our knowledge, we can achieve what the authors call fit-for-purpose governance.
Fit for purpose, meaning we don't just blindly use the same tool for every job.
Exactly. It means deliberately selecting the right futures approach. Predictive, plausible, experimental, or critical for the specific challenge at hand.
Okay, so give me an example of how that works.
So if you are building a bridge, use the predictive approach to ensure it withstands historical flood levels. You want the math there.
Right.
If you are managing a global supply chain, use the plausible approach to test its resilience against shocks. But when you are facing unprecedented societal shifts, like transitioning a global economy off fossil fuels, you need the experimental approach to imagine entirely new ways of living. And you absolutely need the critical approach to dismantle the assumed trajectories and corporate narratives that are holding you back. You choose the lens that fits the purpose.
That makes a lot of sense. Just to pull all of this together for a moment, you know, you might have come into this deep dive thinking that engaging with the future is about gathering better data to perfectly guess what will happen next. But we've learned that it's not about perfectly guessing at all. It's about being actively reflexive regarding the tools and the mindsets we use to construct that future right now in the present day.
And this isn't just a theoretical exercise for academics. We are living in a world facing massive overlapping system changes, from pandemics to climate change. The weight of our past decisions is bearing down on the present, and the anxiety of the future is paralyzing us. We cannot afford to operate on autopilot anymore.
We really can't. The stakes are simply too high to just let the math dictate our options.
We have to constantly interrogate our models. We have to ask what assumptions, values, and worldviews are hiding inside our spreadsheets. Whose futures are we implicitly accepting as inevitable simply because they were presented to us in a convincing keynote address? This raises an important question about our own agency.
It really brings us back to that exact tension we started with. Because there are no future facts, every future is just a script waiting to be written. Which brings me to a final challenge for you, the listener. Take these macro concepts from Magnus and colleagues and apply them to your own life. Think about a specific future you take for granted right now. Maybe it's the trajectory of your career, the way your city is developing, or the role that technology is going to play in your life 10 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
Look closely at that future in your mind. Are you actively designing it? Or are you just inhabiting a fictional expectation built by someone else's ideological power? The next time you find yourself planning for the future, stop and ask yourself, which of the four approaches are you actually using? Because the genre of the movie you end up living in depends entirely on the tools you choose to pick up today.